not only is everyone invited in your Commonwealth School on to the December call, but if people want to send their questions in early so that you're not missed and gives us a chance to review the question and see if it's a question we'd like to answer on the conference call, just send the questions to officelemmy@gmail.com. Any questions that anyone in your group has about Commonwealth schools or scholar projects. And we'll go through those questions and pick some and then come live with your questions on that call. And we're doing a special feature for you, answering questions, sharing insights, sharing what we've learned in the last 10 years. It'll be a great forum. So do any of you have any questions about next month's call? If you do, press 5-star and I'll unmute you. I'm going to look down the list of people here. Okay. Last number of 3816, I'm unmuting you.
Hi, it's Rochelle.
Hi, Rochelle.
I just want to know what that email address was.
Okay, the email address to send questions to is officelemmy, so OFFICELEMI, @gmail.com.
All right, thanks.
You bet. And that's where we'll gather any pre-questions that you might have. Some questions you might want to send in early. It might help us and help your question come to the top. So thank you, Rochelle. Okay. Anyone else with a question concerning next month's call? Remember, usually we have one call a year that you can invite one person to. This one, you get to invite everyone in your whole Commonwealth school to participate. We have more capacity on our conference line now. Okay. All right. And Emily, do you have any other announcements?
Yes, three announcements, actually. One is that we are going to have a writing mentor workshop in Idaho the second weekend of January.
Fantastic.
There'll be a Commonwealth School training in Colorado in March.
Wonderful.
And there'll be more information sent out to the Lemmy Loop for that. And we are talking about scheduling a writing workshop training in California. The last weekend in January. I think it's going to be scheduled pretty soon. So if you are interested in that, I haven't scheduled it yet, but if you're interested, keep your ears and eyes open for it. We'll send information out soon on that. And the other thing is, if I could just encourage you all to take our survey, that would be grand. I think all of you have received a survey on our Commonwealth schools and our scholar projects.
And it only takes about 2 minutes to take the whole survey. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. All right, then. We'll go ahead and move on with today's topic. And, okay, we have a question from Kelly. Let me go ahead and take it, at least the person that ends with 6201. I'll unmute you.
Yes, this is Kelly. I just wanted to clarify that the Commonwealth train in Colorado is actually
I said that twice, didn't I? I'm so sorry.
It's actually what?
April.
April 29th and 30th.
Okay. Awesome.
Thank you.
Sorry, Kelly. That's okay. We'd also really like to welcome all of you on. Anelody and I love each of you so much. I know we hope that you can feel our respect for you and our admiration for you and our gratitude for the efforts that you put forth in your schools and in your families.
Yeah.
All these kids.
I have to tell you, you all have to know that you are making a huge difference in the world. The world is changing. There is a shift happening because of your efforts in everything you do.
It's really humbling when when we sit back and look just even in our own Commonwealth schools that we participate in and the sacrifices of the teachers that go into the lessons, that go into the discussions, when our children come home and want to engage us in conversation that's happening because of your efforts. The second witness to the parents in the home is so valuable. The parents can work and work and work and work at teaching. And when an outside influence in a matter of 2 hours says something that solidifies and testifies of the whole years and years and years worth of things that the parents are teaching, something magical happens, doesn't it, Anality?
Absolutely.
And
it just makes me so happy.
So we thank you. Sometimes you might not feel it. Sometimes you might have a student that you're having a personality conflict with, or a family that you're not seeing eye to eye with, and sometimes you might want to stop. Sometimes you might think the sacrifice is too great. And we just say, hang in there. Hang in there. It's your love and your efforts and your determination to see these students and other adults and parents and families become something wonderful and great is so worth it. And we love you, and we hope that you know that, and sometimes we don't express it enough to you. Today's topic is deep. It's simple and yet can feel complex. And we hope that most of you can be in a quiet room and actually partake and listen fully, because we'll be getting into a line of logic that if you skip a couple of pieces, hang in there and keep listening. If you do have paper and pen, it will help you. It's an exciting topic. It's taken us 10 years to be at a place where we feel like it's time now to talk about these things, that our kids need to be learning this language, and at the appropriate time and in the right classes, you can start teaching these things to your students. And it's really, really exciting. Just to review, last week we went into detail about the trend that there are people who love freedom, but not understanding the power structure of freedom, they're being ineffective in their efforts to promote freedom. And we saw the result of that in 5 different areas. This week, we're going to be talking about a trend that's under the subcategory of the use of rhetoric. So let me share this. Our fourth trend, we started with the fifth trend, and we talked about that last month. Our fourth trend is that there is rhetoric being used by, and we just say, we'll call it the regime, or by people to promote socialism and communism. The specific trend we're talking about today, in fact, the next 3 trends, are subcategories of rhetoric. All right? And so let me go ahead and tell the one we're talking about today, and that is the trend of using propaganda to promote socialism and communism, and this is the specific rhetoric, that our rights are derived from the government, and that the government knows what is best. In other words, the feeling that Washington can save us, and the belief that security is more important than rights. Okay, that's kind of big. I lumped into one thing, but in a nutshell, it's the rhetoric that our rights are derived from the government, or the propaganda that our rights are derived from the government, as opposed to what Jefferson and the Founding Fathers penned in the Declaration of Independence, which is that we have inalienable rights. Okay, Melody, do you want to share something before I go on?
No, go ahead. I'm all with you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. So we're going to start out, and we would like to have you participate on a deeper level this time, and that's another reason why I hope you have pen and pencil, paper, we're going to ask you questions and give you about 30 seconds to just answer whatever comes to your mind on your paper. And this will help you own the material more than if we just lecture and lecture and lecture. And we'll go ahead and share our thoughts with you after you have a chance to write. And if there's someone who has a question during this or wants to share something after we go through this, then I can watch for that on the computer. You press 5-star, and I'll see that your hand is raised. And every once in a while, I'll go look at this. I'll look over here at my screen. Okay, so here's the first question. If you have an individual who buys into the rhetoric that our rights are derived from the government, what is the impact on self? Right? What is the impact on that person being able to see life as it really is, and being able to control their state and coming to a place of truth?
And that's our definition of self, being able to see life as it really is and coming to the knowledge of truth. What is the impact on self?
And owning your life, taking responsibility for your state. Okay, so that's the first question, because we're taking these through the grid of the power structure of freedom. And the first level of the power structure of freedom is our ability to choose, okay, which is self. So just go ahead and write your answer on your paper. Just brainstorm it. What's the impact on self? We have a lot of people who download the call and listen to it later. So if you're driving or you're doing whatever, just answer this in your mind. All right, question number two. If our rights are derived from the government, what is the impact on the family?
As you think through these questions, we invite you all to really just tune in with that truth inside of you that's going to know how this is, what is the impact. We aren't saying we have all the answers. That's
what
we're
have
asking
is
question.
Yeah, what we have is the right question, of several right questions. So if our rights are derived from the government, what is the impact on family? Sometimes how we finally come to an answer that satisfies us is we think of cultures and places and countries where this is believed, and then we just look at the family. Okay. Question number three. If our rights are derived from the government, what is the impact on other individuals? Now, this is a relationship of an individual and their impact on another individual. Okay? So it's very specific. So you have one person who believes our rights are derived from the government, and what does the impact look like? What does it look like, their impact on another individual? All right, question number four. If our rights are derived from the government, what is the impact on toward families, toward other families? like I said, something that can help you find the answers for these are think of times and places and countries and cultures who actually based all their policy and laws on this, that their rights were derived from the government. One that's easy to think of for those of you who teach Keys Liberty is to think of the Red Scarf Girl and how the people in that country, according to G. Lee, were completely believed that their rights were derived from the government and from Mao. And just look at the impact from family to family and how they lived.
Well, that's what communism is, right? It's your rights are all derived from the commune or the group or the society, because we are all one. We're all equal at this level, and so let us tell you what your rights are going to be.
Yeah.
And that's
okay. And then
communism.
Yeah. And then the last question. What is the impact on government forms? So what is the government form? If by the time this is carried to its full length, that the rights are derived from the government, then what does the government form look like?
Yeah, and it's a really
that
good question. It's a really good question to ask yourself over and over again, not just once. I'm hoping you write these questions down, because as you study throughout this year, we really want you to go back to these questions and ask yourself, have I learned more about the impact that this is having on our government form right now?
Okay. Very good. Now, we're going to go ahead and go back to the first question and talk about this. And if there's someone who had this aha and they really want to share it, if there's someone who has a question or they want to add, then press 5-star and I'll watch for your hand being raised on the screen. Okay? So the question number one, what is the impact on self? And Melody, if our rights are derived from the government, what are some of the impacts on self? Would you like me to unmute someone first? We've got Raina with her hand raised.
Yeah. Let's go ahead, you and I, talk about it for a second.
Okay,
we'll
and then we'll take questions and Sarah's comments. Very good.
So if our rights are derived from the government, if that is the case, then there is no inalienable right. And the whole premise of the creation of the Constitution of the United States was based on many of the philosophies coming out of the 16th and 17th centuries, and which were the lines of logic coming from John Locke, and there are actually some more obscure people that we don't know a whole lot about. Roger Williams is one of them, who left England because they couldn't stand anymore the way that we were tromping upon people's individual rights and squelching their ability for creativity. And so if our rights are derived from the government, there is no inalienable right which secures to us our right to life, liberty, and property. So our life is in jeopardy, our liberty is in jeopardy, and our property is in jeopardy. And if our liberty is in jeopardy, then our real freedom is, the definition of freedom is the ability to create.
And to choose.
Right. Well, we choose, we create with our choices, right? Ability to create our lives. So so then our own individual expression is being hampered and challenged.
Very, very good. And something else we added to this on a personal, on that level of creation and choice and self-expression is the self, okay, the ego, the self, is invalidated.
Right.
Just think about that word for just a minute. If you have ever invalidated a child, what do they look like? Everybody see it in your mind. We've all done it by accident or by impatience or by whatever. What does a child look like when they've been invalidated?
Excellent visual. It just makes me go back to the book Power versus Force and talking about the different levels of vibration of the emotions that we have. And I would say that when we invalidate a child, some of the negative emotions that they feel really reverberate throughout their bodies, right?
Yeah.
And so we are going to see it. I was just thinking about how we sometimes stir up in them a pride of or a proud kind of
posture.
Yeah.
Countenance.
And they start posturing with us. Countenance, thank you. They start posturing with us, right? And then we engage in some kind of a power struggle. That could happen. You know, that's one of the things.
And on the lowest level, they're shamed.
They're shamed. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is like the least amount of the lowest amount of
creative energy you can have.
Yeah, is shame. It's the very lowest. You can't go any lower than shame.
Another, it gives permission to blame. If our rights are derived from the government, it gives the individual, the ego, the individual, the right to blame instead of taking responsibility and owning it. This concept, I taught it to a group of college and high school students the other day. Someone had me guest lecture for them. And the hardest concept for these students to understand was when I said, I want you to own everything in your life. So we just kept going around in circles because they couldn't understand if their mom made a dinner and they didn't like that dinner, why it wasn't their mom's fault. You know, because a lot of our country is vibrating on a level of blaming. We see it all over in the news. It's very well accepted. The crab syndrome of blame and complain and point fingers. And it's just accepted. It's a mori that's broken down. Right,
right.
Melody?
Exactly.
And, this comes from something deeper. So, and then the next one is it brings motivation down. When I think of that, I just see pictures of people after their country has tried to use fascism or socialism or communism, and aid comes in to deliver help, and you just look in their eyes. You just think of after World War II and looking in Germany's eyes. Just think about all of those things. And there's that look of no motivation because they can't. The systems, the policies that they're restricted by, they're not that right to life, to liberty, to property has been denied them.
And it causes an immense amount of depression among the people.
Yes.
And it becomes a pervasive energy throughout society is that people are no longer motivated. They're just depressed. And then they have to be medicated.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take Raina's comment here. I'm going to unmute you, Raina. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for letting me say something. What came to my mind when Lunia asked the first question was that I love the way I think it was Anality that talked, well, both of you, I think, in a call a long time ago about allegiance and where is our allegiance. And the first thing that came to my mind was when the person really thinks that their rights come from the government, they automatically look to the government instead of to their God for validation or for all these things that we've been talking about. And so I think that's the biggest thing, is that they lose their faith in God and what he can do, and relying on the fact that he can work through other people and we can work for him to help other people. I was talking to my friend who goes to Germany a lot, and she has friends there and they have a business there. And I asked her what, you know, in the eyes of the German people, what was their thoughts about what was going on with our elections and our president and all these things. And she said, oh, they think, you know, President Obama is great, that we should help other people. Why? And they asked him, you know, why don't you think we should help everybody and why shouldn't we, you know? And they said, well, we believe that we have, yeah, of course we want to help other people, but we should have the right and the freedom to choose to do it, not be forced to do it. And it's true, when we have faith in God, when our allegiance is to God, then we have faith that if someone is in a hard situation, that either we'll step up if we can to help those people, or that other people will step up to help those people. I don't know. I mean, and people think you're crazy when you say this stuff. I mean, even people around in my, you know, my area, but that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Do you know why they think you're crazy when you say stuff like this, Raina? And thank you so much for that comment, because I am, like, way behind that. That was an amazing comment. But do you know why? It's because it's been happening for so long, 150 years, more than 150 years. We have been giving foreign aid to other countries. And
often our enemies.
Yeah, it doesn't, that's not what the founders stood for in any degree, in any degree. It began with one earthquake in Bolivia back in the 1830s. And
wow.
the Congress felt really sad. I'm sorry for these people. I think it's Bolivia. Sorry, I don't know if I have my facts correctly. I just it's just coming to the top of my head. And so Congress came up with $50,000 to send them. And then within a couple of years, there was a great flood in northern Pennsylvania, I think it was. And because Bolivia had gotten aid from the government, then Pennsylvania expected aid from the government.
Wow.
Wow. I remember reading about when Benson, as Secretary of State, called out for us to stop giving wheat to communist Russia when we were in a Cold War, because he said it was lengthening the time and extending their reign of communism.
Interesting.
An interesting concept.
Perpetuating
okay.
The same thing, yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's great impact.
Okay, Raina, thank you. All right, we'll move on to question number two. To remember, if you had an aha you want to share, or a question or something you want to add, then press 5-star on your phone. Question number two is, if our rights are derived from the government, what is the impact on the family, Anality?
Well, first of all, the impact on the family is there's no need for the family. Because the family, another one of the founding principles of the Constitution and the American government was that we had sovereign families, that the father was the sovereign of the home, and that he was the king, or rex publica. He was the king of the home, and that he, through his inalienable rights, governed the family. So now, if the rights are derived from the government, and we have no inalienable right, there is no need for father. Father is the power of father is usurped, and the father in society is misplaced. And so then we begin to have, the statistics of divorce, the statistics of infidelity, and single parent homes, and homes that are not, families that are not working together, and to become a greater entity or greater unit, but are just now a function to create life within, and then from there be wards of the state or be to support the state.
I remember feeling I remember looking at G. Lee in Red Scarf Girl and how she watched her neighbor, who was very elderly, trip on the sidewalk when she was sweeping. And her son was coming down the street, and she thought for sure that the elderly woman's son would help his mother up. And she stood there in shock and confusion when he passed by and refused to acknowledge or help his own mother because he had broken ties with her. The pressure was too great, and it was too important for him to be part of an acceptable state than to keep his ties with his mother, who was on the blacklist. And at the same time, I remember studying things in Hungary.
This goes back to Raina's comment about our allegiance becomes now to the state, and
yes,
which is the crux of it all.
Yes. And so in Hungary, children were taught at school to turn their parents in. Parents had to stop talking freely in front of their children about God or about freedom or about the old ways. And they had to hide their feelings from their children because they would be found out at school. And it turns the children against the parents. It undermines the marriage relationship, and it undermines the responsibility of the father. I think it's really, I was thinking about this, it's a very interesting concept when a father actually feels responsible to his wife and to his children in many areas, responsible to help them become good citizens in one of the areas. And when that responsibility is taken, the way that I like to say it is, Reagan one time commented that when he was a kid, there were no policies and licenses to get a driver's license. He said it was the father's responsibility. He said, of course my dad was going to teach me how to drive the car correctly because I was his son and because his car was his car. So he wasn't going to let me go take my life and his car in my hands unless I had been taught correctly. He says, now, that responsibility has been given to the state. So how many fathers have that same feeling of responsibility as back in Reagan's day?
They don't.
That freedom. Right, they don't. And it's the same thing.
And it's caused fathers to have, really fathers, the role of father, to not have a definition. They have no purpose. And they're afraid to be responsible and fully engage as fathers because, well, first of all, they don't know they can, and they don't know they should, and they're afraid because the government may come in and tell them they're doing it wrong and take away their children.
It's hard. It's just undermining the father and the marriage relationship and the relationship between child and parents, any fealty and any allegiance there. If our rights are derived from the government, we just have to look at the pressure that was put on G. Lee and what was the pressure that was put on her and her mother over and over and over and over again, and it was to break with their father. That's what it was. To break with their father. And if we really think about what kind of pressure
is put on our kids in a public environment to break with family tradition, to break with their father. And just ask, is there pressure for that? And to think, wow, this is because of the belief, this comes partially from the belief that our rights are derived from the government versus having inalienable rights. All right, next question. Now, first of all, are there any comments? Is there anyone who wants to add something or ask a question? Okay. Nobody has a comment right now. We'll go on to the next one. Anody, what is the impact, if our rights are derived from the government, what is our impact on other individuals?
You mean how we treat other individuals?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and how we treat them, our relationship with them, what is the impact from individual to individual?
For those of you who are familiar with the leadership and self-deception, they talk about the analogy of the box. And I would say that our impact is that we get into boxes with other people because, like you said, it gives us permission to blame, to criticize, to judge, to it just gives us permission not to own our own responses. So instead of being responsive to people, we are resistant to people. Creates a resistance within us. And, I mean, how silly, how interesting is that, the fact that our rights are being derived from the government is causing me to be resistant to somebody. Can you imagine that that is the impact that it's having on my relationship with other people, something as small as that, it's not small, I'm being facetious, obviously, or even at the government level, you know, that my rights are being derived from the government instead of I have inalienable right. That's how it's affecting our relationships, and I think it's making it so that our relationships become power struggles between each other. Go ahead, sorry.
No, you're right. It goes to the level, as in 1984, where we become Big Brother. So Big Brother is watching you, and in 1984 that was the government watching you. But what it is the government uses people. And so this is now linked in with the next one. It causes the next one, but our impact on the other individuals is that instead of giving a helping hand, we turn them in. We're Big Brother. We turn them in. We see somebody, somebody's not in their seatbelt. It's plastered all over the DMV. If you walk into the motor division,
vehicle
in your
division,
community,
Yeah,
you will see posters all over them teaching us how to be Big Brother and how to tell on people. Instead of helping, instead of caring, instead of loving, instead of giving, it's that's our impact.
It makes me think of the story that I think it's in the Proper Role of Government where he talks about the man who had the cow that kept getting out of the fence. And the man didn't care, but everybody else in the whole community cared because this was a mean bull. And he was frightening the children, and he was scaring away the other animals, and he kept getting out of the fence. And they didn't have an infrastructure where they could just call animal control and say, hey, get my neighbor in under control. No. It was the community's responsibility to go and talk to this man and say, hey, can we help you keep your cow in the fence? What can we do? Can we help you fix your fence? And he said, in the story basically is, the community came to him and said, could you please keep your cow under control? And that didn't work. So, because he didn't care. So the second thing the community did was the neighbors got together and said, hey, we see that your cow is getting out and it's really bothering our children and it's being a menace to our society. Can we help you rebuild this part of the fence where he keeps getting out. And then they're taking responsibility for it because they're protecting their own inalienable right.
Wow. This leads to the next one, which is, what is the impact toward other families? And once again, to see this at its full length, you just have to look at the French Revolution and how people were living. You just have to look at the Cultural Revolution in China. And what it is that, Anelie, tell me if you agree, everyone is living in terror.
I think it eventually comes to that, for sure. And if you will really examine where you are in your life, you will see there are some places where you feel very nervous about not complying.
It's
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's interesting to put this on this matrix. If our rights are derived from the government, what is the final impact on families and how do we live? True terror was how Geely and her family were living for months, knowing that at any time they would be raided,
yeah.
Knowing that at any time their father could be taken.
And we're not saying, we're not implying in any way that our country is at that place, but that's where it can go. You know, when our rights are derived from the government and we no longer have inalienable right, that's the path we're on.
That's the path some would like to take us on.
Exactly.
It's when I, another example of being in that state, just so we can't say, oh, you know, people don't ever become that depraved. Just think of Corrie Ten Boom and The Hiding Place and how those families that she was hiding, how were they living? And how was she living because she was helping them? The families that were hiding, they were terrorized. You know, if you're hiding in a closet on barely enough food to stay alive and can't make noises, it's hard. It is possible, I will share this, just because all of the forms terrorize you and it's going to be a natural instinct to be in terror, the truth is, like Viktor Frankl said, we still actually, if we can get out of this lie that our rights are derived from the government, we still can have choice.
Right, but we have to
about
be able
how
to
we
identify
that.
We have to identify the lie because you cannot choose out of a lie if you don't know the lie you're believing.
That's right.
And in a minute, we're going to give a little bit of history of why we have, how we've gotten to this place of our rights are now derived from the government and not, and we don't have an inalienable right. We want to take you on a line of logic, though. We want you to see one foundational principle. One foundational principle, inalienable right, being threatened, and what is the impact in our society today?
Very good. Let's just quickly say the final impact on government forms. If our rights are derived from the government, Anelie, what full term does it look like? What does the government form look like?
So if our rights are derived from the government, then there cannot be a government that has anything to do with religion or a foundation of a moral people, right? Because if we go down that leg, then we have to, if our government is based on, oh, we need to have a moral people, then we have to respect that they have the choice to make to create for themselves. And choice is not, can no longer be respected. We have to, the government has to dictate what choices we are making, right? So so first of all, government cannot be based, the founding principle cannot be that the people have to have virtue. sounding principle has to be is that the people have to fear us because we are giving them their rights. So they have to come to us for it. So any form of tyranny is going to be the form of government that we have. If you go back to the principles espoused by Aristotle and then on to Montesquieu, who say that the founding principle of a democracy is virtue. The founding principle of a tyranny is fear. So any form of tyranny is what we're going to have.
That's right. At least a tyranny and anarchy, and the two classic examples of that is the French Revolution and the Cultural Revolution, which both were tyranny and anarchy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, go ahead and take us through the history. And Ellie, this is very interesting. Share with us some of the rhetoric. Remember, we talk about rhetoric, and it's important for us to understand language. It's important for us to understand the epistemology of language and where it comes from. And something that we care very much about is that we begin to hear language and to question, what do they mean by that word? Because I think it means this, but maybe that's not what they mean by that. And to trace it back to intelligentsia. Now, in our scholar projects, the Thomas Jefferson Youth Certification Scholar Project, levels 1 and 2, and then further in level 3, we talk about the intelligentsia. We talk about the power structure in America and how change happens in America. And so some of you are familiar with the term of intelligentsia. Some of you may have done readings all on your own and already understand this concept. But basically, there's a very, very small percent of intelligentsia in the country, and they have impact on policy and forms. And they do it in small tweaks. It's not where the masses have impact every so often through either revolution or through voting. There's different ways that different groups have impact. The intelligentsia has impact through writing to each other and writing to policymakers, and their impact is slow over time. It's a 3% tweak. But
over time,
over 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, 80 years.
Yeah, it's more like 150 years. You have to be able to follow the line of the intelligentsia back a very long way to see how how it's evolved and come. And what it's interesting
how it impacts.
There are ebbs and flows. So the intelligentsia had great impact on the founding fathers. But the intelligentsia that had the impact on the founding fathers were the intelligentsia of the 1650s and 1680s. So you can see that it was 150 years.
It's like looking at what was Locke's impact. He would have been considered part of the intelligentsia.
Right.
You look at what was Aristotle's impact. He's part of, well, he was more than the intelligentsia, but you look at those things. And so, having explained a little bit of that, when she talks about, Melanie's going to introduce a couple of the terms, and we're calling this rhetoric.
Yeah, and let me give you the history behind the intelligentsia first of all, okay? So, in the book, The Ancient State, by Hugh Nibley, he writes about the two different kinds of intelligentsia. We have what we call the true seekers of philosophy, of wisdom, which are called the philosophers, okay? And then we have the authorities on wisdom, which are called the sophists. Okay, so I'm going to say it one more time. The seekers of wisdom, which were called the philosophers, and the authority of wisdom, which is called the sophists.
Very good. So this is derived from both our classicists.
Yes. Well, nowadays you would call them, nowadays you would call both of these kinds of people classicists because they study the classics, yes.
Okay. So one is one is, so following this line, we've got the Socratic method, which is truth seekers and the philosophers. We've
right.
got the
and
Sophist,
which
is authority and rhetoric.
Yes.
Okay, keep going.
Okay. So, and you're going to see throughout history both of these groups
of intelligentsia.
Yes, groups of intelligentsia. You're going to see both of these. You're going to see those who are truly seeking for wisdom, which the whole point of seeking for wisdom is to know the right action. Okay? The whole point of being authority of wisdom is to tell the right action, is to dictate the right action. Does that make sense?
Yep. And now we have a question. Can we take it, Melody?
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
Okay, it's Raina. Hi, Raina.
Okay, well, back on the number five, when we were thinking about government forms and these types of things, we just read The Giver in my class for my and it came, you know, the question came up. I asked the kids, I said, well, doesn't this kind of life look wonderful? I mean, you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to pick your wife. You don't have to go through labor. You don't have to, I was just throwing it out there, you know, asking them, what do you think, you know? And they're like, well, there's no, they said it completely, because this is what it really leads to, I believe. I mean, as far as the tyranny and the anarchy, that happens before, but there, it's almost like the sophists, what they want to see or what they think they want to see is this blissful life for everybody. You know, when I was reading Marx, it was like he had a dream, you know, kind of a thing, that everything was going to be this perfect world. And so here we have this perfect world in The Giver, where nobody has pain, there's no mistakes made, everybody blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't know if everybody's read The Giver, but it's really a good book because it goes beyond the fact of, it goes beyond even the chaos that happens after all this. And it shows that it's not blissful, it's not complete, it's not wonderful. The kids said, well, we wouldn't have freedom. We wouldn't be able to choose. We wouldn't, I mean, look what happened to Jonas. He was able to think. He didn't have to take his little pill. And he was able to be a human being and get connected with who he really was. And I think that's, it goes right back to the number one, that we're not individuals anymore if this kind of line of thinking happens. So that's all I wanted to say. Sorry.
Absolutely. Yes, thank you.
How fun that you're in the Georgics semester and get to do those readings.
Oh, I love it.
Very good. Yes, okay. That's exactly. I was just thinking how we have a lot of literature that actually shows us, it reveals to us the result of when our rights are derived from the government, and yet we stay blind to what's happening around us. Okay, so back to the intelligentsia. So there's these two lines, and the way that the sophists perpetuated themselves was through the schools of oratory and rhetoric. So the history behind it is that the parents of the Greek children realized that if their child were really good at oratory and rhetoric, they'd be able to make a lot of money because they'd have a lot of influence. So they began to turn away from the Lyceum, which was the Aristotelian school, and turn toward the schools of rhetoric, or the schools of oratory, which taught rhetoric, so that their children could make money. And so instead of cultivating philosophers, they began to cultivate sophists. And now I'm not telling you that I criticize one or the other as far as the people are concerned. I'm just telling you what the history is behind these two schools. The Lyceum, which was the Aristotelian, which goes back to the Socratic, was a private entity, and the schools of oratory were also private entities. But eventually, the Caesar Augustus wanted to have some kind of a public school for his, for the children, and he looked at the private entities that were functioning, and he decided that the schools of oratory, which were much more popular because they were being taught rhetoric that would give them ability to provide well for their families or for themselves, and so he took public monies and put public monies into the schools of oratory, and that became the public school system in that time, which still kept the two, at the current time, kept the two schools of thought available, one in a private form and one in a public form. But as you know, public monies can be very powerful, and by the 400s, the schools of philosophy, or the Lyceum, had completely gone out of vogue and now no longer existed, and the schools of oratory had taken over, which was the tradition that they were given, that led into the medieval ages, and many people call the Dark Ages, and well said, they were the Dark Ages because the sophists were in charge, and no one was taught really how to think until around the 1200s, when 1100s, when Thomas Aquinas came along and tried to restore the schools, the Lyceum of Aristotle. And he's the one who began the thought again and asking the questions again, asking the right questions again. What is man? Where are we, good or are we evil? And starting to get people to revive the schools of philosophy. And from that movement eventually came the schoolmen, who came out of the Scottish Enlightenment era, which were those who in the 1600s who published, and they were the John Locke people. They did not come out of the schools of sophistry. They came out of the schools of philosophy. And there still were both schools, and they still were fighting neck and neck. The sophists were those who were trying to support and be part of the infrastructure of the government. And Locke's treatise on two governments, his entire book is a response to Sir Robert Filmer, who was a sophist, who came from the schools of sophistry. And, of course, Locke himself prided himself on the fact that he was not a sophist but a philosopher, and so the fight was going on. It's interesting that the fight turned toward the power going back to the philosophers, and so the philosophers began to espouse inalienable right, and if we took away all the environment that we are born into, what is man? So they came to start to talk about the state of nature. And the founding fathers were highly influenced by the schools of philosophy that said those things. Now, the sophists wanted to keep status quo. That's what gave them the most money, because they had government behind them. The philosophers wanted to seek for truth. And that's the impact that they've been having. Now, let me tell you what has happened in the recent years.
This is important, because it's not that a politician gets up and says our rights are derived from the government. That's not the language that is used. It's different language, and she's going to share just one of the words that's used that falls under the belief that our rights are derived from the government.
Right. So even today, we still have the fight going on between the sophists and the philosophers. And you will hear words that are buzzwords that come from the sophists. They don't come from the philosophers. The philosophers respond to this rhetoric. One of these words is called multiculturalism. Let me give you the history of the word. Back in the late 1800s, when there were so many people coming in and immigrating into the United States, they had an influx of all these immigrants they had to deal with. And the government policy was, we nationalize them. We create a national identity. We become Americans. We create American identity because America is this new, wonderful, democratic place where all man can come to. Let's create an American identity. And the whole public school system was created because they wanted to have a national identity. But that was when the power centers were in the agrarian people. This is really, really important. The farmers were the most powerful people, okay? And then a shift began to happen. The farmers began to lose power because industries began to take over. And by the late 1800s,
And they mortgaged their farms.
They didn't yet. They didn't get to that place yet.
They're not into the 1900s yet, later.
The late 1800s. They're going there.
Because within 30 years, they had mortgaged their farms.
Yes, they're heading there because they're trying to compete with industry.
Yes.
And what they realized is they were losing central power. We were moving from an agrarian society to industrial society, and that their power was being taken from them. And, of course, they were jealous of the influence they were having, they had on government, because they felt like that they were the foundation, or we call them, it's the word in Greek is Georgios. Okay, so they were the Georgios, and they believed that the Georgios were the founders, and that they that their responsibility was to carry on the tradition, and they were losing that power, and so. They began to see themselves as a dying power structure, and so they hired for themselves a group of politicians, and they called themselves the populists. And the populists began to represent these dying groups of power centers. And their job was, and eventually you can probably see how the populists were the impetus for lobbyists. Their job was to go to Congress and to lobby for this particular group of people. Now, the populists saw the power that they were having as lobbyists, and they advertised themselves to be able to represent any group of people, and that's where we began to see ourselves in terms of groups instead of in individuals. The Georgios obviously would never go for that. They wouldn't want to see themselves as groups, but in the earlier tradition, but because they were losing the inalienable right of the individual and the keeping the vision, they thought they would have more power in a group, which they did. Okay. But you can see where that's going to head. So then we started to see ourselves as groups, we started to see ourselves as diverse groups. And instead of nationalism, now we are the policy is to respect people's cultures. So by the 1930s, we were well into, we are a diverse nation that has all kinds of cultural backgrounds, and that these cultures need to be respected. And a new buzzword came about called multiculturalism. And multiculturalism became the respected way to see people as equal. Now, before, the way that you saw people as equal is that we all had equally inalienable rights. And let me tell you,
there was equality before the law.
Right.
There was equality before the law, no matter what your group is.
Right.
It was just about human right equality before the law. And so it's kind of sneaky because instead multiculturalism turned into your rights are determined by your group.
Right.
You were telling me about the man in California who took the case to court because he applied twice to a university and was denied even though he was the best candidate. And the court upheld the decision of the university that they needed to have someone from a different group in that slot. It wasn't about his individual right that he was the best candidate for that position. It was about the group. So as a white male, he was specifically chosen because of a white male not to get the position. So he was prejudiced against while someone from a different ethnic group was chosen for. And that's what it's a group thinking versus equality before the law. It's our rights are determined by what group we are.
Right. So
it's very amazing, Anelody.
Yeah. Well, the whole goal is and Tocqueville talks a lot about this in Democracy in America. He talks about equality and how what we're trying to do is be equal. What we want so much is equality. And so if we can, whatever we have to do to be equal is what we're going to do. Let me read to you something that Tocqueville says. I think it's very interesting. He says, democratic nations are fond of equality. Okay, multiculturalism is a proponent of equality among groups. Okay. So equality comes to its, this is Tocqueville continued, equality comes to its full height of fury when the old social system completes its own destruction. So he is talking about the turn of the century and how the America was founded, and the old structures of equality are completely being destroyed. I remember reading something about what an English gentleman said about America. He hated America because he said the most vulgar and common people talked to him on the streets as if he was one just like them.
Because at that time, it wasn't about the group.
No.
We were equal before the law. Everyone was equal before the law, whether it was a peasant or whether it was the president.
And there was no caste system.
Right. And this is a very different kind of thinking because it uses the word equal, and all of us innately, according to Tocqueville, love equality.
Yeah,
so
we love equality.
So it takes it beyond the mark. Instead of equal before the law as an individual, it's we will make ourselves equal, like what Marx thought. The utopia is everyone is the same.
Yeah,
and that's what Raina was saying.
That's what Raina was saying is that their story of the giver is all about them all being equal, right?
Yep.
Being a forced equality, of course. And let me tell you what Tocqueville says about this, because it's very fascinating. He says, so once they complete their own destruction, after a time when the barriers of rank are thrown down, this is when men pounce upon equality as their booty, and they cling to it as some precious treasure. The passion for equality penetrates every side of men's hearts, expands there, and fills them entirely. This is a passion for equality. It's becoming, it's taking over their entire being. This then blinds them to the loss of the other priceless treasure of democracy, which is their freedom. Because they can discern but one sole object, which is equality.
It's so amazing because now if we just think of different groups and them trying to fight for their right to be equal, we can just name a few of them, and then you can do your own thinking about what happens, because what it does when we believe in multiculturalism, that our rights are derived from our group, and that our group has to get our rights for us.
Right, because you can no longer
Tocqueville,
you
it will
can
take
no
away
longer,
our freedom.
You can no longer talk about inalienable right. Inalienable right is out of fashion, actually, because that is based on the state of nature. Inalienable right is the whole philosophy behind inalienable right is if we take all things away, all your groups away, what are you born with? What are you born in the state of nature? And Locke says you are born with inalienable rights, God-given rights, and this is what they are. Okay? But now what you're doing with multiculturalism is you're putting the level of group back on, and so There is no inalienable right now. Where do your rights have to come from? They have to come from somewhere. They have to be given to you by someone. And the obvious answer is the government. The government now gives you their right. So the philosophy of inalienable right has to be gone. And it's out of date. It's conservative.
This is the line of logic of the propaganda and the rhetoric. So part of the rhetoric that you watch for, the language that you watch for, is multiculturalism. Another language is minority groups. Another language is equal. This is rhetoric we have to understand. I think of groups that are trying to come before the law. One of the ones that pops up into my mind is the gay and lesbian groups. They want their rights, and they have their lobbyists, and they have their groups that are going to get them their rights. And what happens when a group, a minority group...
The sophists are 100% behind them because they are part of their proponents of the rhetoric. And remember, the sophists get their money from public funding. And so whatever the public leaders are telling them that they want, that's what they're going to promote.
It's almost impossible to win it. I remember being in the teeny tiny town of Monticello where there were only 2,500 of us, and an issue came before the school board, and it was under this category, but all of the funding from the government, the posters, the this, any education that came from the public funding, and the proponents for freedom had to fund it themselves. And so it was just a sad display of propaganda throughout our whole town, you know, in the grocery store, at the library, in the schools, any building that you went to, 10-1 propaganda for the basically the loss of our rights. I mean, I remember going, I don't get it. Where are they getting their money? Why is only this group getting to advertise? Or, you know, I mean, it's an amazing thing to follow the trail and to see. But what happens, and then you have to read that quote again by Tocqueville, because under the argument or the rhetoric of equality, what ends up happening when a minority ends up having special permission and power and what they call equality, but the policy favors that group, okay? So, like, that man didn't get into the university, that even though as far as who was better, because it's not based on equality is very different than equal before the law. I remember
reading a short story once
in high school where the musicians, an actual musician, got into, and maybe you guys know this story, I'm just remembering this, though, an actual someone who was very gifted and a musician was put in the group of musicians. Now, everyone else in there was not musicians. And so there something was done to their hearing and something was done to him so that he played as poorly as them. I don't remember if it was a pill or what it was, because everyone was equal. No music can be played. I mean, if you just think about this on a science level, that if we want equalness, we would never have a piece of art that took our breath away. We would never hear Chrysler and be moved. We would never experience greatness. Just the line of logic alone that we are equal as far as gifts and talents and ability are concerned. That was thrown out the window. The man who had excelled and should have had that position, because the rights were not derived from God. The rights were derived from the group, and it was another group's slot.
Now
to be able to have the opportunity.
You'll hear these accusations from people who are well versed in the rhetoric. Things like, you're an elitist, or you're ethnocentric, or you're a bigot, or you're a homophobe. Those are called ad hominems. They are logical fallacies. What they are is they're red herrings. They're trying to throw you off the path. They're trying to throw you off the scent. They're attacking your personal self so that they can get you off the scent that we're trying to now move all things towards multiculturalism. Okay? So I want to actually go back to Tocqueville again, and I want to go back to Locke. Locke says the thing that we must avoid beyond all things is extreme egalitarianism, that there is a balance of equal, exactly what Tiffany's been saying, what you've been saying. There's a balance of equal. Equal means equal before the law, not equal things, not equal. It really doesn't even mean equal opportunity. All it means is that you are equal before the law. If you come before the law and you've committed murder, you get sentenced just like your neighbor who commits murder. It doesn't matter if you're black or white. Now, we have recently, in the last 15 years, seen a case where a black man was brought before the courts. And because he was black and a football player and popular, it was difficult to give him a fair trial, and many people believe that he was completely guilty of murder and was given his freedom. And a lot of that is a result of multiculturalism. Even though he was guilty, he was not equal before the law anymore because his group protected him. Being in his group, it protected him. Okay, so Tocqueville says, democratic communities have a natural taste for freedom. He also says that freedom is not the only, democracy is not the only place where they can maintain freedom. Okay, but that democracies have a natural taste for it. Left to themselves, they will seek and cherish freedom, democratic nations. But for equality, their passion is ardent, insatiable, and they will sacrifice any freedom to obtain it. The paradox of equality is that without it, freedom cannot be established. Okay? But, I didn't finish the quote here, but he says, and without it, without equality, despotism cannot be supported.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Melody, thank you for giving us some of that history. Thank you for helping us understand. I'm so glad that you shared with us those ad hominems. The red herrings, some of the words that will be used against the philosophers, usually by the sophists. These are just key words that we can watch that's happening. They're flying all around us. But let me go back to this, because this is so interesting. The answer still lies in the power structure of freedom. The answer
yes, it does.
Still lies in us, in all of us, owning our inalienable rights. and taking responsibility for them and being the best stewards we can be over them. And then moving to the next level of helping our families and then teaching other individuals and then supporting and serving as individuals and families, other families, and moving toward the impact on government policies and forms. It's still the same formula.
And it takes a tenacity. It now, because we are being faced with the sophist and sophistry, now because we are being faced with rhetoric, and now because we are being faced with red herrings, because we are being faced with all of these things coming at us, it takes a tenacity that you have never experienced before in your life. You are going to have to be courageous and tenacious. You are going to have to stand like you've never stood before. And you're going to have to know what you stand for. And that's why this education, Thomas Jefferson education that we do, is all based on the philosophy that you get your own education. You must be educated, or you will not be able to stand. You will be thrown over by the rhetoric. You will be pushed over by the rhetoric. And I'm telling you, I feel so passionate that our government, in my opinion, was created through the inspiration of God. And if our government was created, I believe this with all my soul, if our government was created through the inspiration of God, then the philosophers who had sway on the founders' hearts had to have the truth of our state. I believe that the philosophers, the lovers of wisdom at that time, the men of reason at that time, nailed the truth about men. They weren't always 100% correct. You can read their writings and you can say, oh, yeah, well, I disagree with them on this. But that's okay. They would have been fine to have you disagree with them. But the sophist is not okay for you to disagree with them. They will attack you personally. You must get an education. You must be able to stand on principle. It will be the only thing that you have behind you and under you as a foundation, because the winds of the sophists are going to blow hard in the next few years. Thank you.
Thank you, Anelody. Thank you so much. And again, we thank each of you for helping your families and your students be on that path, be on the path that Anelody's talking about, to think and to be. All right. We'll see all of you next month. Let me remind you that we've invited you to invite everyone in your Commonwealth on next month's call. Every year we have one call where you can invite one other family, but this year our calling capacity can hold more people, so everyone in your Commonwealth is invited. We're going to do a special feature on scholar projects and Commonwealth schools. You can send any question you have about scholar projects or the new Commonwealth school to us, because we'll be answering questions on that call, and you can send it to officelemmy@gmail.com, and we'll have those questions. Please try and send them early so that we have them gathered and Anelody and I can go through them. Invite everyone. Go ahead and give the number and the code to anyone in your Commonwealth school. Like I said, this is the call that you get to invite people on. It will be the December call. And, of course, you have your group call in between and the classic call to listen to. And then Anelody and I will do a special feature next month. So thank you, everyone. Have a great holiday season, for coming on my favorite time of year. I love the holiday season of this time of year because it draws us close to our families. All right. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye, Melody.
Bye-bye.